Welcome to Talking Books on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and in this series I discuss books and what they mean to my guests on the program. Today I have with me in the studio Dr. Michael Zammit. I must have interviewed well over 100 people in these last years, and every person has a different story to tell and a different eater in their lives. And Dr. Zammit has an interesting one. He started reading architecture around 1973, early 70s, but after passing the first year, he decided that architecture was not going to be his métier, and he joined the philosophy course, graduating philosophy honours in 76. He started working on a master's, but those were rather turbulent years for education in Malta, and the course was discontinued. He was offered a place at Cambridge, but was unable to take it up owing to financial reasons. Scholarships and sponsorships were in rather short supply at the time, so he went into teaching maths. This seems like a rather sad story, because obviously missing out on Cambridge is something that one would like to do. However, my guest turned everything really into an opportunity. Firstly, the university library became a haven, a place to, as he says, assuage his thirst for reading, a place where he says he discovered realms that he had never been told about. And secondly, he made a life-changing friendship in Goads over the Harvard graduate, a polyglot who had at that time already mastered about 20 languages, including Greek, Latin and classical Arabic. He introduced Dr. Zammit to the Sanskrit language and its wealth and culture. Thirdly, he discovered the practice of philosophy as a way of life, reading Pierre Hadot, then still in French, and joining a local organisation that provided the opportunity to try this out. He then started learning Sanskrit, reading the Upanishad, and meditating on the commentaries of the child sage Sri Shankara. He will no doubt correct my pronunciation later on. He was also reading Plato at that time and translated Plato's Apology and other excerpts into Maltese. When the university was recalled into existence, he was admitted as an MA student, started teaching philosophy at the sixth form, what was then the sixth form, then with the philosophy department, where he completed his doctorate. He helped found a junior college, was involved in the design and set up of the systems of knowledge examination, and at present is running new courses in the Department of Philosophy here at the university, and more recently was a founder member of the Malta Classics Association, about which I'm hoping we shall have a chance to say a word. Welcome to you, Dr. Zammit. Thank you. The first question I ask all my guests, and I shall ask it of you as well, is what was your first meeting with the written word?
Well, the written word is a strange thing to speak about. My meeting with it, well, when I was young, I could read, of course. I was sent to schools where reading was obligatory. But I wasn't particularly attracted to any of that until when I came to university and discovered the library here and discovered the subjects here and discovered the poetry that was there. And further than that, discovered that poetry is best spoken orally rather than read. And so my fascination was with this, with the sound that poets actually, how can I put it, the sounds that they sort of create, yes, and enhance. And what that does is to bring society to its best features, to its best moments. So I was fascinated by that, and this happened late. This happened when I came across the library at the university. The subjects that opened out in that library were immense, you know, psychology and philosophy and poetry and the classics, of course. And after that experience, I could never look back.
When I asked you which book or books you would like to talk about on this program, you said something which caught my attention. You said there are many books which one loves dearly, and for yes, you, yes. There were philosophical books, yes. Such as Gaston Bachelard's The Poetics of Space, but there are few that of those that one lives. Yes. Could you explain a little bit what you meant by that comment?
Yes, the written word, and therefore the idea and language in general, is what we are, basically. Has very much to do with the human being and the way that we see ourselves in life. And so human beings move along with this, I think at first, a fundamental problem. What we know is one thing very often, and what we do is a different thing. In certain realms of our lives, these two areas are separate. So we know certain things but are not capable of doing what we know. And this is where it matters in the realms of love, in the realms of relationships, in the realms of law, justice, ethical, moral behavior, this sort of area. There are all sorts of things that we know, and very few of them are done. And we know this ever since we're 10, possibly. Now, very few books tell you about how to bridge this schism, this chasm that opens up in the heart of the human being. And those books that do tell you about this are the ones that one lives by. I was fortunate to meet some of these books. They came in the shape of myths, they came in the shape of philosophies. The Homer's works. Homer's works at first started to appear to me as stories. What's Homer talking about? You know, the Iliad and the Odyssey. What is this all about? Is it really about a war? Is it really about a journey? Until I started to discover that this struggle and that this journey is what people go through in their lives. So I started to realize that behind Homer there is life, and that text is a metaphor for life. And so this is a sort of thing that one starts to live with. And then questions start arising. What really does Achilles stand for? What really does Homer himself stand for? And so all these things start to emerge. These are the books that one lives by.
So you're not, we're not just talking about life-changing books, because one does come across those, but books yes. which give you direction.
Yes, they give you an energy, which is a very, very fine energy, which is not a physical energy. It's the energy that we use when we pay attention. And that energy, well, in Sanskrit it has a name. In English it doesn't. But that energy is very, very much related to what we would call, I suppose, consciousness, awareness, alertness. And that is what we live with. In life, what matters is our awareness. If we are not aware, particularly if we are not living the moment, then we are not alive, really. We are either dreaming or pretending to plan. And so this becomes very important, to tap into this very, very fine sort of realm, very, very fine energy. These are the books that tell you about it. The Upanishad, for example, you mentioned the Upanishad. These are very ancient texts. Incidentally, many of these texts that one lives by are not written in prose form at all. They're written in poetic form. And so now, at this moment in time, I'm looking very much into the issue of whether poetry is a better medium to express philosophy than other media. Of course, Plato wrote poetry before he decided to move into writing his other texts. We don't have that poetry, but we know that Parmenides, possibly the next greatest philosopher before Socrates, well, he left us a poem, which is still needs, I think, to be fathomed. And the Bhagavad Gita is a poem, and the Iliad is a poem, and the Odyssey is a poem. The Odyssey is telling us that life is like a journey. The Iliad is telling us that life is like a fight, like a struggle. Well, the Bhagavad Gita tells us something totally different. And that is what started to attract me to this realm, to this world.
Before talking about that, and I'm hoping hearing a little bit of Sanskrit from you.
Yes.
For those listeners who aren't familiar with the Upanishads, perhaps you could just give a very brief description of what we're talking about here.
Well, there are these very ancient, I don't like to call them texts. They themselves, in Sanskrit, they're not called texts at all, because they were not written originally. They were orally transmitted for thousands of years. They were written, they were put to writing about 3000 BC. That's when they were put to writing.
But
these,
they were written.
They were orally transmitted and kept within a nomadic civilization. You see, because poetry is the mode of expression of the nomad. Poetry is always on the move. Poetry is always in the presence, in the presence of nature, in the presence of self. When human beings settle down, then they start tracing their dicta, their orality, and they start committing it to paper. And that's when it starts to die. But that's another story. So these Vedas, they're called. Veda is a Sanskrit word from which we derive the word wisdom in English. These Veda, these bodies of wisdom, they are ancient, and they are very, there are four Veda. They are very enigmatic, difficult to understand, but there were several cultures following these and trying to make heads or tails of what these Veda were about. And as part of that consideration came up the Upanishad. The word Upanishad itself means sitting down with a teacher and discussing the philosophy of these texts, which are predominantly poetic. So the Upanishads come at the end of the Veda, where there is an attempt at bringing these Veda into the manifest lives of people. So they are actually poems or poem-like creations that explore the realm of the relationship between the human being and the creation, between the human being and the absolute, between the human being and itself. They explore ultimately the being, what being is, which in Sanskrit is called Atman.
You say that these texts, for want of a better word, sort of must have grown over many years as an oral tradition from one generation to the other. Do they have an original composer?
These particular texts, the Veda and the end of the Veda, which are the Upanishads, are not authored. They are. It is claimed that they are revealed, and that is very important, because then standing next to those and coming from that body of knowledge are the authored texts, such as the Bhagavad Gita, the Song of the Lord. That's what the title means. Now, the Bhagavad Gita has an author, although its author is as enigmatic as Homer. You know, there is the Homeric question: who was Homer, what is Homer? We know that the word Homer itself means a compiler. So who was this compiler? Well, the Bhagavad Gita is written by somebody who is also called a compiler. And the name for compiler in Sanskrit is Vyasa. So this is again the Vyasa question.
Where did these texts originate geographically?
The culture that spoke Sanskrit is not particularly Indian. The culture that spoke Sanskrit was originally a nomadic culture that lived outside of India, beyond the Himalayas, between India and Asia, between Asia and Europe. It was a very large nomadic culture, And at some point, it is claimed that this culture split up and started settling down. Some of these people moved across the Himalayas and settled in India. These are the people who kept the Sanskrit intact. But many others moved into Europe, and some went into the Middle East. So we've got Iran, which means Aryan, and we've got Ireland called Airai, which also means Aryan, indicating that these people settled all the way from Persia round to Ireland. And of course, in India, the Sanskrit was then codified and kept intact, whereas in these other places, it developed into other languages. So, for example, classical Persian, which is called Parsi, is a derivative of Sanskrit. Latin and Greek are derivatives of Sanskrit. And Sanskrit is now known as an Indo-European language. And the cultures, of course, then, you know, whatever happened to them, well, that's the domain of the historians.
Yeah. In fact, this was a question I was curious to ask you. I remember when I was reading Anil's Ghost, which was a book by Michael Anjata, there's a Sri Lankan character who says at one point, I'm not interested in Western culture. It's all too modern for me, sort of. I'm interested in only in discovering the East. And I did, at that moment of reading it, sympathize a little bit with him, because I myself feel that I come from a very Western-centric background, tradition, society, call it what you will. Yes. But hearing you speak, perhaps he wasn't so right at the end of the day.
No, not exactly, because what we call Western culture is derived from this other culture. It's Indo-European culture that we're talking about. And well, you can take words in English, German, French, Spanish, if you like, take them back to Latin, take them back to Greek, perhaps, and then immediately you're in the Sanskrit realm. If you just open the Greek dictionary, it's every page is full of Sanskrit roots. So you can see that there is this connection. East and West is a sort of dichotomy. It's a sort of distinction that we grew up to make, which possibly wasn't always there when human beings were a bit freer, especially in their movements, especially in their lives, than we are. This Western-Eastern dichotomy possibly was a bit more liquid. Then, of course, as time passes and first the nation-state experiments of the Egyptians around the rivers and the Indians around the Ganges, and then the city-states of the Greek, you know, these all started to form individualized countries. And these individualized countries started to acquire a nature, a character, a personality, and then they became intact, and then they became hardened, and then they had fights. And then things started to fragment in this way. And so, yes, I think he is not actually correct, because we need to make this connection. Indeed, the Americans, as we were speaking before this, the Americans in Harvard University, for example, presents Latin and Greek together with Sanskrit.
So people, they recognize that connection.
So they recognize the connection. People like T.S. Eliot read Sanskrit, Latin, and Greek. People like my friend in Gozo read Sanskrit and English literature. In Europe, for I think mainly predominantly political reasons, the world of the classics was always related to Latin and Greek, and the world of Sanskrit was always kept a bit at a distance. They were two large worlds, and of course in the past century, in the 20th century, we started to realize that they are related. Indeed, they are intimately related. Saussure was a Sanskrit scholar, and he is the man who, because of his Sanskrit studies, designed and created linguistics as we came to know it. So now we are, you know, the latest speak in Oxbridge, as I hear about it, is that Sanskrit, Greek and Latin, indeed that classical Latin cannot be really thoroughly known unless you have a basis in Sanskrit. That's what they're speaking about at the moment.
In fact, I would like to mention this point because time is rushing, yes, rushing by. The Malta Classics Association, this is something that you as a founder member, and there are others with,
yes,
you, you felt that there was a need and that perhaps this was a good moment in time to yes, revisit this idea.
This idea, yes. Mm. Yes, and fortunately, some of us have come in touch with Sanskrit, and some of us are experts in Latin and Greek, and so there was this ready-made environment, which is, it would have been a pity not to
take
profit
advantage
from.
Of, yes, exactly.
Yes,
uh-huh,
yes. There is also, of course, the other world, the Semitic world, which even again there are very, very subtle movements indicating that there is a very intimate and deep relationship between that world, the Semitic world, and the Indo-European world of languages. It's only starting now, and people I know of, a scholar in Scotland who is actually looking into Hebrew and Greek and trying to see whether there are relationships. I would say that we should look into classical Hebrew and Sanskrit and look at whether
the
there
affinities.
Are affinities there.
What do you think, so, as far as today's young people are concerned, what do you feel the Malta Classics Association can give to the study? Can it give a sort of a push to the study of the classics in Malta? Is there a need for that?
What there is a need for is for people to start to wake up to the necessity that we need to start looking at ourselves and the world and our relationship with that world in totally new lights. And a language like Sanskrit, languages like Latin and Greek, can actually provide this. And this happens regularly in cultures and civilizations. You will find that wherever there is a renaissance, there is always a connection with some very ancient classical culture, possibly language. It could be Hebrew, it could be Latin, as with the Gothic Renaissance in the 12th century. It could be ancient Greek and Latin, as with the 15th century Renaissance in Florence. It could be Sanskrit now. And of course, this, you know, looking at basically words, sentence structures, grammars, what we're talking about here is the mind. And what we're talking about when we talk about the mind is the heart. And that indicates, and that is where attitudes start to change. So if one, and you can see that young minds are looking all over the place, especially in the realm of sound. I find that they are very, very attracted by sound. Now this could be my own sort of take on this, because I myself am attracted to this. But I find that sound really has the potential to touch people there where it matters, which is their attitudes. And so the sound of Sanskrit, the sound of Latin, the sound of Greek can start to open the mind of people.
So yes. Are you going to give us a little taste of that?
Well, yes, there is a beautiful, in one of the Upanishad called the Isha Upanishad. Isha is a word that stands for the Lord, the landlord, the Lord of the creation. There is a little incantation that starts with the sound Om. Om is of course very well known in the pop world nowadays. It stands for the creation. It stands for the substance of the creation. It is symbolic for that. And then there is this incantation, which goes like this: Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purname Vava Shishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Shanti means peace, and it is repeated three times because the idea is that one wants peace in the material world, peace in the subtle world, and peace in the world of the divinities, you know, which Homer is so fascinated by, these divinities there. And the incantation is speaking about perfection. Purna is the word for perfect, for completeness. And Purnamadah, therefore, would mean that there is perfection there, everywhere. Purnamidam means that there is perfection even here. If you take perfection from perfection, you're left with perfection. And what emerges is always perfection. And this is what the incantation is saying. This is the beginning of the Isha Upanishad, which then goes on to speak about how one should renounce oneself, which means should renounce oneself and should renounce the world. The word for renounce in Sanskrit literally means to rename, as in English, after all, because to renounce, to announce, is to name something. To renounce doesn't mean to let go of things, but it's to rename them, which means to see them in a different light with your attitude, with your heart. So I can be looking at a microphone, but I can renounce it and rename it as my tool for communicating with people around me. Even though there is only one person in this room, there is still the spirit of a thousand others with whom this microphone is making it possible for me to contact. So that's a renunciation. Rather than calling it merely microphone, my attitude sees it as a means of communicating with others. And therefore, suddenly, the whole situation starts to appear differently, slightly differently.
Well, certainly in the past I've always known that studying Sanskrit was a very good exercise for the mind, yes. in as far as an intellectual exercise was concerned, but certainly hearing you speak has made me look at it in a much wider way, and obviously one could understand that it can be appreciated, yes. At a thousand levels. Well, Dr. Michael Zammeet, thank you very, very much for coming on Talking Books to talk about that today.
Thank you for listening to Talking Books. I hope you can join us next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.